You're probably aware of all the stuff that lives inside of you. You need things like bacteria in your gut to enjoy the benefits of proper digestion and good health. Even if the concept grosses you out, we all have a microbiome, an internal ecosystem of tiny creatures that live in us and generally make life better for us. But wait, there's more. It's not just living things that have microbiomes. We also have bacteria and fungi and more living alongside us in our homes and workplaces and other buildings. Sue Eishak studies them at the University of Oregon in the Biology and the Built Environment Center. She's our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, our regular joint venture with the U of O. Sue Eishak, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Good morning, and thanks so much for having me on the show.
It's very good to have you. So I noticed that it's the biology and the built environment is written as bio, capital B-E. How do you pronounce that?
We call it BioBE for short because it's quite a few names in that title.
Okay, BioBE. I just wanted to see what the shorthand was. I noticed your earlier work with nutrition and food sciences. How did that lead to a study of microbiomes in buildings?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. So back in 2010, I started my PhD at the University of Vermont, and I was actually working in animal science. And my project was to investigate the stomach ecology in the rumen of the moose. So I wanted to know what sort of bacteria and protozoa and fungi were there and how they might work together to help digest that woody biomass, that kind of bark and other tough fibrous things that moose are eating, and how that might benefit them and whether or not we could use those microbes. That sort of expanded to looking at other animals and mostly working in the gut. I ventured off into soil, in agricultural soil for a little bit. And then at about 2016, 2017, I was on the job market again, and I saw this posting for BioBE. And I thought, well, what is the built environment? I hadn't really heard of this in microbiology before, certainly not where I was working. And I started looking into BioBE and the work that they had done and looking at the building ecosystem, so the collection of houses and roads and cities, and all of that human habitat that we've created for ourselves, and looking at how that structures the microbial community in and around us. And I sort of had this, moment. You'd think that the built environment would be totally different from what's in the stomach or what's in the soil, but actually it meshes those two things really well. So humans and dogs and plants and all those occupants of that built environment are giving off their microbes all the time. And whatever is coming from outside also ends up in the built environment, either because you're tracking it in on your shoes or your clothes, or you might have your windows open, and that brings in a lot of bacteria and fungi. And so all those two things sort of coalesce in the built environment and create the microbes that we find in our homes.
So does each building have a unique microbiome, like, say, each individual human or each individual moose?
It does, yeah. It ends up picking up the fingerprint of all the occupants that happen to be there, whether or not that building is using maybe mechanical air ventilation or window ventilation, how connected that building is to the outside, and of course, whether or not pets are allowed in the building.
Well, you know, unlike a living thing, buildings don't need a microbiome for health, I'd presume. So to flip that around, is there anything inherently unhealthy about having all these microbes with us?
That sort of depends. The nice thing about the built environment is that it's not straightforward, and there's a lot of ways that you could take that research and a lot of interesting things that you can do. So we're pretty good about knowing what specific things we don't like to have in buildings. We certainly don't like to have black mold. We certainly don't like to have that sort of gross smell that you find in really damp buildings. That's usually microbes. And we certainly don't like to have infectious disease in our buildings. But we don't really know what we would like to have there. We haven't really defined what a healthy building microbiome might be. We struggle to even know what a healthy human microbiome might be. So we're not entirely sure what we would like to have in buildings, but there are at least a short list of things that we would prefer not to have in buildings.
And what's on, you mentioned, black mold, the smell from dampness, infectious diseases, things like that. This kind of brings me back to some of the experiments we did in science class, like in middle school and high school, where you took the pieces of tape and you went down to the water fountain and stuff and then put them back in petri dishes and auger and watched what grew. Do you do similar work to that? I mean, are you scanning buildings and trying to pick up stuff and see what's there?
Yeah, we do. Quite a bit of our work first starts with characterizing what's actually in that building and on each of those different surfaces, because in the same way that you have different body sites and those body sites will dictate what microbes can live there, there are certain aspects of the built environment that will encourage certain bacteria, fungi, or viruses to survive or to die off. So certain microbes prefer to live in the sunlight or prefer to live in the darkness. Certain things need a high level of moisture, and you might only find them in bathrooms and kitchens, but maybe not on your dry vinyl flooring, that sort of thing. We first want to know what aspects of the built environment encourage specific things to live there. And then you can take it one further and say, well, we know that most microbes in the built environment are living off whatever organic material we leave behind. So we're giving off a lot of skin cells all the time, and they quite like to eat those. We might be depositing food particles or crumbs all over the place, and that's, of course, a nice feast for most microbes. But what happens when there aren't those things available? Can the microbes eat those building materials, or, you know, the clothing or the vinyl flooring or all the other things that we've brought into this built environment? And if so, how can they do that? And what aspects, what actual carbon compounds are they digesting?
Wow.
So quite a bit of what we're doing is, yeah, just kind of mapping the built environment and figuring out what factors actually modify it, so that we can then turn around and say, okay, if we want to foster certain microbes here or get rid of certain microbes here, how would we design that building to do that? Do we want to change the surface material so that things can't stick? Or do we want to change the surface material so that maybe the bacteria can stick? That sort of thing.
Sue Ishak, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, our joint venture with the University of Oregon. That is where she's an assistant professor of research in the Biology and the Built Environment Center, otherwise known as BioBE by the people who work there. Join us on the exchange. Got questions about what's inside a building that that you know of, or just wonder what's there generally? Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I know we've talked to the researchers who have pointed out the fact that we live among a lot of arthropods. There are all sorts of creatures like that in our buildings. But you're looking well below that in size. You're just focusing on the micro stuff?
Indeed, yes. Or at least I am specifically. There are actually quite a lot of built environment researchers around the globe that are working either collaboratively with us or on their own things. So there are a number of arthropod researchers out there. And even arthropods also have a small microbiome that they will pick up and leave behind in buildings.
Oh, that's right. I didn't think about it. So yeah, they have microbiomes too. And then they live within the microbiome of the building as well.
Exactly. And so do those mice and the rats and all the other creatures that you hope aren't in your buildings, but probably are somewhere.
All right, so now that we've gotten to this point, Sue, I want to ask about, I mean, there are some people who are going to hear this and be freaked out enough by what we're talking about to scrub their houses and workplaces maniacally. Is that the wrong approach?
It is the wrong approach, but often the approach that people go to after meeting me, people usually feel like they need to wash their hands after a conversation. But the take-home message here is that the microbes were there before you knew about them, and probably unless you had black mold, they weren't causing you any harm. And they're certainly going to be there even after you've scrubbed over your entire house. We find microbes in clean rooms, in sterilized rooms, even up on the International Space Station, there are microbes. So they're really impossible to get rid of. And it's probably a fruitless effort to go ahead and do that. And on top of that, we're not entirely sure that we do want to get rid of all those microbes. We're used to living in a really dirty microbial environment. And it seems like we might actually need that feedback. So you don't want to get rid of them. You just want to learn how to live with them as roommates.
So when you say we're used to living in a dirty microbial environment, you mean when we lived out of doors?
Exactly. Yeah. Humans have a really long history of co-evolving with the microbes in their environment, or specifically those ones that are on us. They provide a lot of benefits, not only in digestion, but they help train our immune system so that we don't go overboard every time we might have an infection, because that can be just as dangerous as having the infection itself. And so we need those microbes to train our own immune system, and we get them from our food and from each other and from our environment. And so if we're thinking about living in really sterile rooms, what is that going to do to the microbiome that we accumulate as children? And how are we going to learn to fight off infection if we only have, you know, these super bugs that can live indoors, or if we don't have any bugs living indoors.
So in a sense, it's part of training our immune systems, perhaps, to have microbes around that our bodies get exposed to, go, oh, okay, yeah, I can deal with this one.
Exactly, yeah. In the way that people have realized, oh, maybe we should send our kids out and get dirty a little bit more often. Maybe we don't want to get rid of all of that dust. We just want to know when we should get rid of that dust, like in a hospital setting.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now I have to ask about if there's anything in the design or maintenance of the building that BioBE itself occupies that has come about because of the research that goes on within.
Ah, well, we certainly use our windows quite a bit more than our ventilation system.
Huh.
We're on campus, we're in somewhat of an older building that just got renovated. And we prefer the fresh air to that mechanical ventilation. We also really love daylight. But then again, the other half of BioBE is Energy Studies and Buildings Lab, and they have a real soft spot for daylighting and the benefits that it can provide to not only the bacteria and to your energy bill, but also to humans themselves.
So I want to make it clear, though, because I know the more we seem to talk about this idea of, like, exposing our kids to more dirt and stuff, nobody here is recommending licking the kitchen floor or anything like that, right?
I probably wouldn't. But then again, it might not actually hurt you to begin with. So if you do feel like licking your kitchen floor, please take note of any symptoms that might develop and then call me afterwards. So if we're going to do this, we might as well collect data.
All right, so you mentioned some of the things that go on in the BioBE building. People don't, like, get careless about the, you know, tossing pizza slices in the trash can or anything because it's healthy, right?
Well, mostly around college campuses, you don't end up having leftover pizzas. But in general, we're not a super clean folk. We try not to scour our desks every day, and we try not to use harsh chemicals all the time. That being said, we do really appreciate when people stay home when they're sick. That tends to really help reduce infectious disease spread. So you don't need to necessarily scour the entire building surface when everybody comes in sick. Just have them stay home.
Well, that's a great point, though, because when you start talking about things that won't necessarily improve your immune system, but in the near term, break it down. I know when we were reminded recently about how long measles can hang in the air around people because of the outbreak, primarily in Washington State, but under the Oregon side as well, that some diseases really can stay on surfaces in places like the built environment for a fairly long time.
They can, especially certain bacteria and fungi can form these hard spores. So they'll go dormant for a while with this really hard outer coating, and they can survive for up to months in the built environment. And it almost doesn't matter what you do. They can survive UV light. They can survive harsh chemicals. They're really, really good at surviving in places. I mean, these microbes have been around for much longer than we have. And so they're really good at surviving tough conditions. And so if you think about, like, a hospital setting or even your homes, people who are sick or even not sick and just carrying those microbes might be giving them off regularly, and they're just hanging out waiting for that particular opportunity. So the other half of what we do is not only to find out what might be there, but also try to understand the particular circumstances about how we pick those microbes back up and how we might be getting sick from them again. That's a little more difficult to do because nobody wants to get sick from their buildings, and because you don't pick up nearly as much from the building as you might be putting down. And so it's a lot harder to see, but you can kind of see that nicely in hospital settings where you have this patient population of people who are really immune compromised. And it's a lot easier for them to get colonized from a bacteria or a fungus that they might pick up from their built environment or from other people in that hospital setting. And so a lot of the work that we're doing is partnered with Oregon Health and Sciences University, OHSU, up in Portland to track certain pathogenic microbes through the built environment and try to figure out what are the circumstances in which a patient might pick it up from the environment and actually get sick from it.
I noticed that. One particular focus is Clostridioides difficile.
Yes, very good. That one's a tough one. Yeah, Clostridioides difficile, or let's just go with C. diff. That's a particularly nasty bug sometimes. You find it often in soil, in digestive tracts. In fact, a lot of people carry around C. diff or you know, might be passing through and they don't have any symptoms. But unfortunately, when it does decide to infect you and you do have this kind of ongoing problem with it, it can cause really nasty gastrointestinal problems. It can make you very, very sick. It can keep you in the hospital for quite some time. And a good number of patients can actually have this recurring infection where they just can't seem to kick it. It's one of the bugs that a lot of hospitals have their eye on in terms of trying to reduce it, because it does tend to target your really immune compromised patients that have enough going on without having to worry about this.
Right. So really the last thing you want to have in a hospital environment.
Mm-hmm.
Sue Eishak is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the University of Oregon's Biology and the Built Environment, or BioBE Center. She's a research assistant professor, and we're talking about the things that live with us in buildings. A couple of phone calls and emails here. Becca in Lane County wants to know if there's a test she can get for black mold.
There are tests that you can get for black mold. I don't do them personally, but I know there are a number of businesses pretty much anywhere that will come and help you test for black mold.
Any home kits that
you're aware
of? I can't
get more information, but probably a good Google search would do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Larry in Arcata asks, what is living in our matrices, and can we control the bad things living there? I'm not quite sure what he means by matrices.
Matrices. That's an excellent question.
Or maybe it means I think he might have just spelled mattresses. Let's do that. Let's go.
Gotcha. Yeah, there are some things living in your mattress. Most of the things living in your mattress come from you. So you tend to give off quite a bit when you're sleeping, and your mattress can pick that up. One of the nice things is that if you just kind of take the sheets off on a regular basis, you wash them regularly every week or every 2 weeks, as it were, and let your mattress kind of to dry out and air out after you've slept every night, that can really help reduce the microbial load. But most microbes really depend on either moisture or food. And any time that you can reduce their access to moisture or food, you can help control their growth.
Jamie in Medford dropped off his question by phone. He wants to know if anybody mentioned used chewing gum. I know we haven't so far, but what are some potential issues with that?
Ooh, chewing gum. You know, I'm not entirely sure. Chewing gum is pretty nutritious, but then again, it's also very sticky and it's really hard to break down. So typically, microbes will go for the easiest things first. They really like sugars, they really like fats and proteins, but anytime you've got something really fibrous or really sticky, they tend to have a little bit more trouble with it.
And how about sharing chewing gum?
Sharing chewing gum. Well, it kind of depends how close you want to get to that other person. We do share our microbes with the people that we live with, and that's kind of dependent on our relationships and how intimate we are with them. So, for example, if you have a significant other, or even if you have a dog, you probably share quite a bit of your microbiome with them.
Interesting. I notice you. Your philosophy is that microbiology is for sharing. Do you mean the subject or the microbes themselves?
A little bit of both. Yeah. I do share quite a bit of my microbiome with my dog, but I'm also pretty passionate about science communications and trying to improve science literacy, and then also showing people what else there is to science. So it's not just us sitting at a lab bench having our eureka moments. It's a lot of looking at spreadsheets or having meetings or really thinking about problems and trying to come up with creative solutions. There's quite a bit more to science.
Friday, I noticed, was International Women's Day, and apparently you're active with 500womenscientists.org. Tell us about that project.
Yeah, so 500 Women Scientists was started a couple years ago, mostly just as an open letter pledging support to science from scientists and on behalf of scientists. And one of the things we're really focused on is gender equality, equity, and inclusion in science and broadly elsewhere. So the Eugene Pod is just one of almost 300 chapters that have just really exploded globally. Again, we only started at the end of 2016. We want to not only have science advocacy on campus, but we want to have a better conversation with the general public about what it is to be a scientist and how they can help not only improve science communications with us, but also kind of improve gender equity and inclusion in their own lives.
I noticed a fair number of people out there still trying to convince girls to get into the sciences. I guess I'm a little surprised in this day and age that there's still this sense that, like, oh, that's really a boys thing, that we still think in those terms, that anybody does.
It is, and it is slowly changing, but it's not just about getting them to sign up. It's about getting them to stay. So often you find that there are some things that make being a woman in science or being a woman anywhere really challenging. There are cultures about, you know, where you have meetings or when you have meetings, or who's important enough to have in the room. One of the big things we face is that we often get praised for our hard work, but sometimes we don't get praised for our ideas, and we're not thought of as leaders or creative or able to come up with these really fantastic science ideas. And so we're trying to change that by showing people, no, we're here. We have these ideas. We're already leaders. We're already scientists. Like, put us to work.
It is hard, I guess, to be among the first people of a certain class to get into a profession that's been dominated by another class.
It is, certainly. There are a lot of attitudes to change. The nice thing is that usually when you do, it can be a little rough at first, but then people realize that diversity of demographics can also spark diversity of thought, and that makes it better for everybody. It's really helpful to have a lot of different perspectives in science or in any conversation, because everybody has a different background and a different way of looking at things. And when you put those all together around a table, you can come up with some really fantastic ideas.
All right. Lots of fantastic stuff, it sounds like, going on at the Biology and the Built Environment Center, BioBE, at the University of Oregon, where we find Sue Ishak, an assistant professor of research, doing what her philosophy says. Microbiology is for sharing, and we have gotten a good sharing here today. Sue, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, it's been a pleasure. Curious is our monthly segment involving researchers from the University of Oregon. Thanks to the folks at the U of O for directing us to Sue Ishak.